Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. And that time I said it right. One of these days I'm going to leave the bloopers in some of these things. I know I already have a hard enough time talking, but that's the second time I had to record that because I could not say the word university. Anyway, welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I almost slipped up on Baptist that time. I'm Matthew Gage, and this is the 30th lesson in our series on the Book of Acts. We're beginning to wind things up. Let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 more lessons. Hard to believe that we're wrapping this thing up, but we're getting very late into the life of Paul. We're in chapter 24 of the Book of Acts, going to be covering the entire chapter, so I mean, we're about to run out of chapters in the Book of Acts. That's what my plan is. I think I've already spoken about it, is basically from here out, we're going to cover a chapter in each lesson, and it just divides up very well to do that. And then we're going to tack on one more lesson and kind of finish out with some of the traditions about Paul's later life, what happens after the Book of Acts, and not necessarily going into church history, but at least to fill out the what we believe traditionally, historically about the last days of Paul, because Paul does not die at the end of Acts, and you know tradition is that he's beheaded in Rome, but there's some different, and we'll get into all that. There's some different versions, different accounts, different theories, but we'll cover all that when we get there. Right now, we're kind of continuing our series of lessons that I've titled Paul and the Jews. And as you will remember, if you've been listening along way back into or a couple lessons ago, back in chapter 21 and chapter 22, Paul returned to Rome, returned to Jerusalem, and to observe a feast. He had made a vow, and anyway, he's in Jerusalem. He meets with the church. Unfortunately, some of those same people who were always giving him trouble in his missionary journeys, some of those Jews from Asia Minor and Greece saw him, recognized him, and you know, stirred up a riot. Paul is saved by the local Roman garrison, and he is taken before the Sanhedrin the next day. He is able to kind of divide their opinion, knowing he wouldn't get a fair trial anyway, but divide their opinion based on, you know, some of those the classic divides between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And a plot is revealed where the Jews were going to kill Paul, and there was a bunch of guys who evidently starved to death because they vowed they wouldn't eat until they killed them, and they didn't kill them. So the local commander, Claudius Lysias, I didn't talk a lot about him. I kind of let y'all down as I was doing some research on this. I read a little bit. We don't know much about him. I did say I was going to look up his rank was a chiliarch. That's close as I'm going to get to pronouncing it right. I couldn't find a pronunciation guide on that. But basically it meant a ruler of 1,000. It's a Greek term. So kind of a leader of a battalion is something that I saw it compared to. But a pretty high-ranking guy there. Would have been over a centurion, just to give you some more common Roman titles. So, anyway, Paul's been sent to the Roman procurator Felix and is now awaiting trial there. And that's kind of where we ended up in the end of chapter 23. And I spoke a little bit about Felix. Let me remind you, his full name is Marcus Antonius Felix. He's Roman procurator of the province of Judea, somewhere 52 to 58 AD. And like I said last time, the dates on his life and the timeline I've been using for the dates in this lesson did not exactly mesh, so just excuse that. And probably more famously, he's a younger brother of Marcus Antonius Pallas, who was Secretary of Treasury in Rome, basically, and a very powerful freedman. Did a little bit more reading on him also, preparing for this. Not a lot's known about him. He minted some coins. which actually have the name Nero on them, which is kind of interesting. Some people collect them just for that reason. There's just a handful of the Roman procurators and governors and such that actually minted coins, and he was one of them. And one other thing that Josephus calls him Claudius Felix and tries to tie him into being a freedman, you know, a former slave, now freed of the Emperor Claudius, or at least that line of families. But it's very difficult. The historian Tacitus says that he was a descendant of some Greek kings. So, there's just a lot of different opinion on that. A little bit of soap opera stuff with his marriages, and we'll kind of talk about his second one. He actually marries two women named Drusilla, so very interesting. So anyway, let's go ahead, and I think that's about everything I wanted to cover to get started. I'm kind of on a tight schedule. This does not need to go more than about 30 or 40 minutes because I've got to get ready for church, but I happen to have a little bit of quiet time to record. So let's quit rambling. Let's jump right on in. Chapter 24 of the book of Acts, verse 1. And after 5 days, Ananias the high priest ascended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. Okay. So there's a few things let's point out here. It's been 5 days. Why has it been 5 days? Well, number one, it took a few days to actually get there. Plus, remember, there was a feast day coming, so the Jews would have been busy, especially the high priest, would have been, performing the rituals of the feast and stuff. So they had to wait a couple days to wrap that up, plus a couple days travel to get there. So it's now 5 days. Paul's been there for 5 days. Finally, here comes Ananias, the high priest, which is really kind of interesting that he would personally come, he's trying to take out Paul himself, didn't just send a delegation. He felt the need to actually go to the Roman seat of government at Caesarea. I'm going to try to say that right, Caesarea. I believe that's the proper pronunciation on that. So anyway, he's going. The word descended is used because it's actually elevation, that Jerusalem was much higher in the hills. They went down towards the ocean, so they descended down. And it talks about them hiring an orator, Tertullus. This trial appears to me to be a Roman-style trial. And I'm not an expert on the Roman customs. I've read a little bit about them. Romans love the trials. In fact, it was kind of, their sport, I guess, during the day. If you didn't have nothing else to do, you went down to the forum and you sat and listened to the trials. And, I mean, the great orators of the day, were the great lawyers. And guys like Julius Caesar made very famous speeches in these trials. People like Cicero got their name in this, but it really, enabled to persuade, people for judgment and stuff. So basically what they're doing in this Roman style deal is they've hired evidently the best lawyer, got this guy Tertullus. We don't know about him. It's assumed that he's probably a Jew, but a Hellenized or, a Greek Jew, and that he's been trained in Roman law, and also, in has familiarity with the Jewish customs. But evidently is just a great speaker, probably the leading lawyer. He's the Perry Mason of his day, or, I don't know. That's just the first lawyer that popped in my mind. I want to say Johnny Cochran, but that's not quite the same thing. But this guy's the best orator, so he's going to go present his case before Felix, the Roman leadership there. It's going to be his case to hear and to judge on. So they hire the best orator they've got. And basically, this trial is going to come down to both sides presenting their side, Tertullus speaking for the prosecution, Paul speaking his own defense. Of course, now you think Paul is not a slouch himself when it comes to speaking, and maybe he's not versed in the finer points of Roman law, but nonetheless, he is a great speaker himself. So we are going to jump right on in. First thing we'll see here, verses 2 through 8, 9, something in there, is Tertullus's accusation. So let's begin verse 2. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness. So he's complimenting Felix, number one. and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence. Really buttering him up there. We accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Yeah, you're such a great guy and we love you. Please find in our favor. Verse 4, notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee. Like, so I'm going to quit buttering you up and get on with it. I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words. This is just classic lawyer speak, isn't it? Just the flowery word. You can see he's playing the crowd here. He's trying to butter up the judge, and it's like, well, listen, I don't want to be tedious. Let's just get down to business, and I'm just going to speak a few words and trust that your fair judgment, because you're such a great guy, you'll trust fair and find in our favor. Verse 5, for we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Let me stop right there and point out the sect of the Nazarenes. That was the name going at the time inside Jewish circles for Christianity. They were called Nazarenes. And so that's what that's speaking of there. Let's see here. Anything else I want to point out? Basically, he's trying to paint him as just this evil person, that he's a rebel. He's stirring up trouble among the Jews everywhere. Now, say the appointment to be over Judea, I don't know how to take it for a Roman guy. Is this prestigious? Because it's got some wealth, you can tax them, but sometimes it's a great responsibility, because it's a very turbulent nation. They've had plenty of problems with revolts and different rebel groups and stuff. So at the same time, it's this great responsibility. So they're painting Paul as some type of a rebellion leader, and that he needs to be dealt with because, he's trying to cause trouble, not just in Judea, but everywhere. And, if the Jews are stirred up everywhere, it's going to look bad in Jerusalem. And, just trying to paint him as an awful guy. Verse 6, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law. So I like this. He's going to say, well, look, he tried to mess with our temple, break our laws, and we would have done something. Verse 7, but the chief captain Lysias came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands. Verse 8, commanding his accusers to come unto thee, by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. And so it's like, look, Lysias came and took him. We would have dealt with this guy. We're sorry to even bother you with it. But Lysias came and brought him. But now we're here, and, we're just telling you what's going on. And so you'll know what's going on. So verse 9, the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so. So he says, isn't it so, fellas? And I said, yep, that's right. That's exactly right. So, verse 10, it's kind of odd. This is kind of the way that the Roman trials were very kind of informal. There actually could be, comments from the peanut gallery at times. And, so it's very likely Tertullus could have said, my friends, the Jews over here, is that not so? And they said, oh, yes, that is so. It's not like, all the properness of the American judicial system based on the British judicial system, calling up a witness, only they can speak. And if someone speaks up, you bang a gavel and out of order, it's not like that. This is, has a little bit of a circus atmosphere to it. It's a little bit more open to that. Than that. All right, so verse 10, now Paul is going to speak in his own defense. And so 10, then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, so, it's like, okay, I've heard his side, and Paul, what do you got to say for yourself? Beckoned, doesn't even speak to him, it just kind of points at him, just a motion, the upraised palm motioning towards them, like, it's your turn. I'm doing that like you can really see it in the magic of, audio podcasting. So, anyway, back into him. Okay, so Paul begins to speak. Forasmuch as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself. So he starts buttering up too. It's kind of nice. Verse 11, because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for the worship. He's like, look, I've only been here 12 days. I've only been in the nation 12 days. How much trouble can I cause? 12, and they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people. That's in rebellion there. Neither in the synagogues nor in the city. Verse 13, neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. It's like, first thing he does is say, look, they're accusing me of a bunch of stuff, and I'm innocent. I wasn't causing trouble. I was just here, you know. I didn't do anything wrong. What they're accusing me of, and of stirring up all this trouble and trying to profane the temple. They can't accuse me of that. And remember, all that the whole thing about profaning the temple was just the fact that they saw him with some Gentiles, and they. Someone said, hey, I think he's trying to get those Gentiles into the temple. And, the rumor mills got to going. And pretty soon, I guess he had took them in there and they had slaughtered pigs. And I don't know what all had happened. You know how the rumors get. But Paul's basically saying, look, I'm a Jew. I know what I'm doing. I haven't caused any trouble. Verse 14. This is funny. First off, Paul says, I'm not guilty of anything they're saying. They can't even prove it. Verse 14, now he's going to say, this is what the real issue is. But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and the prophets. Verse 15, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and unjust. Verse 16, and herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. So what Paul says here is the big issue is I'm trying to worship God in a different way than they are. And I still believe, in the Old Testament, I still believe in the law and the prophets. But what the big problem is just, I'm trying to do it in a different way. And he even says, I'm trying to just, follow, my conscience and do everything right as I see it. And, he's basically saying, look, I'm just trying to serve God in ways that ought to be allowed. He was still a Jew. He was still practicing Judaism. It just, he was a Christian now. He believed that the Messiah had come. He put his faith and trust in him. And he could go on probably for hours just on those points, just saying, look, they're accusing me of accepting this man's Messiah. Well, let me tell you why he is the Messiah. He could just go on and on and on and prove to them everything he did, everything he believed had a scriptural basis. So it's not like he was coming totally out of left field with any of this. Everything he did and believed was based on the teachings that they also claim to follow. So, basically he nails it right there and just says, look, I'm trying to serve God differently than they are. And that's part of the danger you get into, even in Christianity, as we get into, you have to serve God our way. We become Pharisees when we focus on what we do. And we think, well, I read my Bible 3 chapters a day and you don't. So I am better than you. That's almost what the Jews did to Paul. They're just like, okay, well, we don't agree with you, so therefore you must be wrong, you must be destroyed. I mean, it's a lot more complex definitely than that, because, they rejected the Messiah, they had the Messiah crucified, and Paul accepted him. Paul is the one in the right here. But just as a little side note, a little warning to us, I've been doing a lot of thinking on that here lately, how quick we are to judge, and usually in ways that make ourselves look good. But we're so quick to judge other people when, a lot of times it's just our opinion. It's something stupid. There's not really good scriptural reason for it. But we tend to judge and dismiss people just over stupid things. And that's really a bad application out of that. I apologize for that. Verse 17, let's move on. Now, after many years, I came to bring alms to my nation and offerings. Verse 18, whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult. So basically saying, look, I haven't been here in years. I came in, some guys from Asia saw me. They're not even from around here. Verse 19, who ought to have been here before thee and object if they had aught against me. It's like, those are the guys that started it all up. And if there really is a problem, they ought to be here because they're the ones that started it. Verse 20, or else let these same here say, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council. 21, except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. So, basically, Paul says, what have I done wrong? The only thing you can get me on, and the only thing these men can find me on, because, listen, they examined me. They found no fault. They found no criminal behavior. They found no heresy. The only thing that this is that age-old thing, which you're surely familiar with, you know, there, King Felix, is that that group right over there says there's not a resurrection. This one says there is. And it's that same old argument is why I'm here today, is just because of that. So verse 22. And when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, so he actually understood what was going on. He understood, you know, that religious division and the beliefs and stuff. He deferred them and said, when Lysias, the chief captain, shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. So basically, what Felix is going to do, he understands when Paul brings that up, you know, Felix is like, oh, it's about that, huh? This is one of those little Jewish squabbles over their, you know, silly little religion. You know, that's just what's going through his mind. He understands it. He knows about it. So he doesn't have to even question, well, what's that mean? Really? Oh, wow. Some believe it, some don't. No, he understood it. He knows. So basically, it's like, okay, well, we'll just have to, we'll call for Lysias, and when he gets here, we'll straighten all this out. So basically, you know, the court is adjourned, and we'll just have to wait for further testimony. Verse 23, and he commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come unto him. Okay, so kind of what's happening here, Paul is released. He's not being kept in bonds or, you know, in a cell, but he still is a prisoner. He's not totally free. He's under the guard of a centurion. He actually very likely could still be in some type of bonds, but he's committed to the care of a centurion. Who is to watch over him, make sure he doesn't escape, you know, make sure he doesn't flee the country. It's not like house arrest, but this isn't like being locked into a dungeon. And he's also given, you know, some privilege that, you know, he's allowed visitors. You know, if someone comes to see him, let them in there. You know, basically he's being treated about as fairly as a prisoner can be treated without just being set free. This is actually very fair. And a very, very light punishment compared to what the Romans are capable of. All right, so now in verse 24, let's wrap things up. We've had the trial, and basically Felix has not decided. In fact, don't get your hopes up. Felix is not going to decide anything. And so Felix basically says, okay, well, if this is, you know, basically sees, okay, this is a Jewish, you know, little squabble thing. So he's not going to make any type of judgment on it, and basically says, well, when Lysias comes back, we'll figure out what goes on. Well, I don't know whether Lysias came back or what, but Paul's still in bonds. Now, verse 24 through 26, there's a little bit of a famous encounter here. And it's going to lead to, so an illustration that's used, and in fact, it's been mentioned in Psalms, where Felix is almost persuaded to be a Christian. He doesn't say that, but he's actually moved by Paul's presentation of the Christian faith. So verse 24, and after certain days, you know how long that is, we don't know, but Paul's still a prisoner. When Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Okay, let's pause here for a second. Let's talk about Drusilla. Now, like I said, history reveals, Felix was married three times. His first wife was Drusilla of Mauritania, I think I'm saying that. Actually, kin to Emperor Claudius. He actually divorces her and then marries Drusilla, who was a daughter of Herod Agrippa the First. And we don't know a lot about her. One of the things I read said that she is probably about 22 years old when this happened. She's actually about half the age, somewhere around there. Felix is probably in his late 40s, so she's probably about half the age of her of this husband. They've probably only been married somewhere around 4 or 5 years. The interesting side note on her is that when it came to the let me flip over here to this one. I've got Wikipedia pages open. Drusilla was born somewhere around 38 AD. She's 20, 22 years old, somewhere at this time. We actually know the exact date of her death because she is one of the few notable people that we knew that died at Pompeii and Herculaneum in 79 AD when Mount Vesuvius erupted. Her son by Felix actually passed away also in that. So the historians, I think it's actually Josephus actually mentions that. And I think it's the historian Pliny the Elder and basically Drusilla are like the two most notable figures, you know, that were lost in that eruption. But you can read a little bit more about her. Like I say, if you want to get into Josephus, he covers her quite a bit, and with all the petty gossip and court stuff and the life of the rulers. So let me flip back over here, get my notes back up. That's a little bit about her. So the most interesting thing about her, well, number one, she's a Jew that married a Gentile, which is very, very odd, and evidently did that basically just thinking it would bring peace or something. Let's see here. I'm trying to say it actually has. This is actually from Josephus. Says, when Felix was procurator of Judea, he saw Drusilla and fell in love with her, for she did indeed exceed all the other women in beauty. And he sent to her a person whose name was Simon, a Jewish friend of his by birth, a Cypriot, who pretended to be a magician. Simon endeavored to persuade her to forsake her present husband and marry Felix, and promised that if she would not refuse Felix, he would make her a happy woman. Accordingly, she acted unwisely, and because she longed to avoid her sister Bernice, envy, for Drusilla was very ill-treated by Bernice because of Drusilla's beauty. I'm so used to the proper way of saying it would be Berenike. But most people would say Berenice or something like that. But prevailed upon to transgress the law of her forefathers and to marry Felix. So basically, she was kind of tricked into marrying and hoping she would get treated better and marries Felix. So anyway, interesting thing on her. That's from Josephus, Jewish Antiquities. I don't know what the reference there is, but anyway, that's all free. Interesting little side notes. So anyway, Felix and his wife send for Paul, and probably in their own quarters. This isn't a trial, but just send for him. Maybe they're on thrones, and he's before them, or maybe this is something very informal. We don't know. No information is really given on that. But so Paul is going to speak, about the faith in Christ in verse 25. And as he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, "Go thy way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee." So basically, as he's teaching, it's interesting. What does he teach about righteousness, temperance? That's the lifestyle and the principles behind the Christian faith, and the judgment to come. So he's actually talking about what lies ahead in the great white throne judgment and such like that, evidently. And so it actually gets to Felix. He's it says he trembled. he's moved by this. He refuses to act on it. Does the probably the judgment part probably scared him? You know, I'm just guessing. But basically sends him away. We don't know how close he is to being a Christian, but evidently this moved him. He just says, Paul, just go away. And more convenient season. It's like, I'll call you back when I get a chance, you know. It's one of those, don't call us, we'll call you kind of things. And basically sends Paul back to being a prisoner and never calls for him again, evidently. Verse 26. He hoped, that's Felix, also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might lose him. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener. Oh, wait, oh, excuse me. That's what I get for speaking and not paying attention. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener and communed with him. So he spends more time with Paul. More and more time with Paul, hoping he'll get a bribe, which shows a little bit of his character, which is pretty commonplace for Romans at the time and mankind in general. You know, just a little bit of money, a little envelope full with green dollar bills, and you know, you can get your way. And basically, he's hoping that Paul will pay him off, or maybe Paul's friends will, but none of that ever happens. So, verse 27. But after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room. That's not just, he didn't just like knock on the door and go into his bedroom. That's he actually took his place. He's now the new Roman procurator. And Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. So just to help stay on the Jews' good side, he doesn't release Paul. Paul's still a controversial figure. I'm sure this probably comes up, you know, all the time. Like, hey, what are you going to do with Paul? You know, and basically he doesn't want to kill him. You know, maybe he has developed some type of friendship with them to an extent. Doesn't want to kill him, knows that that's wrong, and really can't since he's a Roman citizen. But can't release him because the Jews won't stand it. So basically just there's the happy median is just we'll just leave him as a prisoner for the time being. And that's where we'll cut off. We'll talk about who Festus was. And no, we're not talking about the guy on Gunsmoke there. But we'll talk about Festus, and we'll continue on with that next time. And let's see here. Will that wrap up? No, I got two more lessons in Paul, our series with Paul and the Jews here. So next time we'll jump into Acts chapter 25, and we'll cover it then. I appreciate you listening. Check back BaptistBasics.org when you get a chance. The other resources there, hadn't had a chance to do too much lately, but hopefully get back caught up on the podcast and get back ahead. That's what happens. You get ahead and then you get behind again. I was ahead and had built up a nice little, I've got a few ahead, so I had a pretty steady release schedule. And then before you know it, you know, I go a month or two without really getting a good chance to record and come back to bite me. So I'm glad I had this opportunity. I'm glad that you listened today. I'll say check out BaptistBasics.org. You can email any comments to podcast@BaptistBasics.org. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening today. God bless you.